This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
One more case to talk about this morning. Before anyone knew his name, David Anthony Burke was a kid recording music on an iPhone in his sister's closet in Houston. By 20, prosecutors allege he's responsible for the death of a 14-year-old girl, the alleged dismemberment of her body, and a cover-up that reportedly lasted months. The question underneath everything in this case, what made him? Not the moment it allegedly went wrong, the years before that, the specific conditions of his life that reportedly combined into something no one saw coming. Siobhan Scott is with us to help break it down. Siobhan, David Anthony Burke, he was raised in a household where the only music allowed was gospel until he was 13. And we know the type of music that he ended up making. It ain't gospel. But brought up strictly very religious. Then the internet blew open the doors, and these very non-gospel music started coming out, eventually making music about romantic homicide. Nobody in his life is reportedly helping him process any of it, really. When a kid goes from that level of a sexual and cultural restriction straight into the unfiltered digital world that apparently he went into, and you still, I would imagine, if your family is very strictly and staunchly religious, they're probably not changing their belief system just because you found the internet or video games. What does that turn into here? Because he's not learning it from his parents, school, or peers. He appears to have emulated some of these ideas or got some of these ideas from the games he's playing or the music that he was listening to that was outside of the realm of the very strict world that he was in. It's like the floodgates open and suddenly you have access to everything. That's kind of probably a dangerous place for a young, impressionable mind that doesn't really have any sort of tools to navigate it properly.
Yeah. And, you know, a couple things popped into my head, two thoughts. Let me not lose them both. Okay. One is that sometimes families are very overtly religious, but there's a hidden dark side, you know, and we see all these people with these religious, I mean, politicians, highly religious, and, you know, I don't need to even name all the names.
Duggars.
Yeah. I was thinking.
Robin will name the names.
Yeah. But there's creepy hidden stuff going on that kids may be aware of. So there could be some of that. The other piece is that kids often raised in really repressive religious homes go opposite. The minute they turn into teenagers, I had one client who was raised very strict Mormon. Her mother wouldn't allow her to wear a bathing suit as a little girl. I mean, everything was so controlled, no television. And what did she do at 13? She ran off to LA to become a hooker. And I had her as a client a few years later. So, so you can have that oppositional effect too. But adolescence is the period of brain sculpting where identity, values, integrity, empathy, where this really develops. And if you're spending, I mean, I know he was doing homeschool. How much time in homeschool was actually spent online, you know, with parents not really paying attention, which is also very common. And we know that online life, technology shapes social development. It shapes values. It shapes identity, and he certainly went off track somewhere.
So, Siobhan, I'm going to kind of flip an optic potentially and ask you this. So, let's do glass half full with the parents that they weren't hiding in the darkness with their religiosity, their extreme religiosity, if that's what they had. But they was really what it was on the surface. And he hit that point where David wanted to kind of rebel against that, like we've seen in places like the Duggars and other cult-like mentalities. But what's the likelihood then that he can then recruit the parents based on greed? Because that's, I think IBLP, I think you know, Jim Bob had the greatest of intentions when he did that, but he got caught up in the almighty dollar and then started turning a blind eye to the abhorrent behaviors of his abusing one accused and one convicted sons. You know, is that a possibility? Have you seen that happen where greed overwhelms the religiosity?
You know, I have not typically run into it personally with my cases, but I think in the media, when we see these awful outcomes and the whole influencer culture, it's definitely having a huge impact when people are getting this kind of money and a sense of power, you know, that goes with it from their kids' behavior. And also going back to not terribly psychologically insightful and not coming from a place of integrity with, you know, what is this doing to my kid? It's like they just don't get it. They're missing some pieces.
No critical thinking again for the win.
Well, and especially with the integrity and values, because if you're being brought up in a culture that is super strict, like you can only listen to gospel music, and I'm sure there's other restrictions that are reminiscent of that surrounding that, and you're held in this cage of we're doing it because we have integrity and these are our values. And then suddenly, he gets into music. And then the person who has also been sitting there telling you and being so strict on what you can and can't consume starts seeing, again, this is my conjecture, that looks like it might be a little lucrative over there. Oh, look, he's making a little bit of money. Look, he's getting a little bit of attention over there at that. Mm-hmm. And then that person that instilled those values into you, and maybe you still believe them or not, but you're exploring the outside world yourself with your own autonomy. And then that person that still represents kind of the base, the rock, if you will, of the integrity and the values that raise you that way, is suddenly kind of also being like, that's okay. I'm going to encourage this now. You're like encouraging the same shit that it was like, this is the outside world. We don't participate, you know, with all those folks, is now kind of about it. That to me, I think would make one have questions about their own sense of integrity and values. If the people who are closest to you and have shaped you and you viewed as being kind of rock solid turn out to be quite moldable, a lot more like silly putty than a solid rock of values, if you will, which then as you're trying to form your own values, I would think make those even probably more dangerously moldable because you don't have guardrails. You're just basing everything off of what you've been taught in your home your whole life so far. I'm wondering how much of the playing fast and loose with the morality rules from the parental standpoint then had an effect on David and in a way indirectly enabled him to find a path of going on Amazon and buying a burn cage and two chainsaws as a solution to the problem of the 13-year-old he knocked up, allegedly.
Yeah. The greed, I think, not only from parents, but the people around him who were, you know, his entourage and people trying to latch on to his fame, that does pollute thinking, and it's unfortunate. But again, a lot of people don't have insight. They're not monitoring themselves. And it also means when people were making money or saw the promise of gaining money and power from him, they're not confronting problematic behavior anymore. And it's sort of like he gains as a young person who's, you know, really got poor judgment and lack of integrity. Nobody's challenging him.
When you're brought up with that level of strict outlook on life, the religiosity and such of fire and brimstone, this is horrible if you participate in it, blah, 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 blah. And then you do cross into the world of the sinners and you're doing some things that are not good. And you've been told it's instilled in you of just how horrible the consequences are to your actions that you know that you have participated in. Does that fuel the motor even more to cover up a murder, to do more things to conceal, to protect, to hide, because of the shame that might be instilled in you for all those years of everything that you were taught, and also to protect from the inner shame you may have, but then the shame of those finding out around you that were the religious figures that you are now letting down. I'm wondering how much of all of that has a fueling effect to this story, if he did it.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I know based upon my hyper-religious upbringing, I would never, you know, even consider murdering someone and cutting their body up. But but that's just me. I would kind of lean toward maybe he never bought into it.
Okay.
That, you know, there are there are kids raised, young people raised in homes where there's that kind of family going on. But really from the get-go, they're rejecting it. They may be playing the game and going along with the parents, but it's never really integrated into them as part of their reality.
And I think, you know, to the fueling part, I think David, you know, again, innocent until proven guilty, was so broken as the nature part, that the nurture part was just fueling it. Because there's, I know, I'm just going to cite one example of someone who seemed to make that transition fine. To, you know, you can have your own personal opinion. But Katy Perry, you know, her father was a pastor. She grew up in a very religious household, and she made that transition just fine, you know, and kind of rejected that lifestyle and you know, didn't go out murdering people and had enough checks and balances because she wasn't broken to begin with. And so I really think David is just a very, very broken individual, you know, from the nature part and then the nurture. Kept throwing kerosene on this thing, and then the greed kicked in, and then we really saw how well linked, again, pure conjecture, the parents were to their religiosity. I can't even say that word. Because then the mother's like managing the money and taking everything in her name. I mean, so if they were so rejecting of the things he was doing because of their religion, why were they so closely bound to it? Anyway, just interesting.
I think that's the question. Yeah, I mean, it's a question. I mean, they have been fighting off with subpoenas or some, I forget what it was, with the grand jury for quite some time. And I get it. I mean, you're going to want to insulate yourself, whether you have anything to hide or not, because anything can be used against you. But I don't know. At the same point, too, if you don't have much to hide, what I don't know. There's a lot of questions here, and it's a lot of things where I'm not going to the parents and going, you're responsible for this. But I think there's a lot of shame, I think, that would probably naturally happen to anybody if your kid goes out and does this. Whether you were a good parent or a bad parent, you're going to be looking for every possible thing. Did I cause this? Did I do something wrong that may have driven them to do this or that? And you may be able to put your finger on it and go, shit. It was the extreme religiosity or whatever it may be.
It's
I mean, you can go, well, I was totally wrong there. This is horrible that this is how this affected that person. It's not how you intended or what you thought it would be, but it in fact is, you know, it is the result, the cause and effect, whether you intended it or not, as so many things in life are.
Look how different this is, because we just covered the Anna Kepner case where, you know, the son accused of killing his stepsister and the parents, whoop, we're done with you. And this one, son's accused of killing 13-year-old, and the parents are like, not doing that. Interesting, isn't it, always?
Yeah, I think there's some are somewhat similar overlaps, though, too, of insular behavior and you know.
Controlling narratives.
Controlling the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're human. They're going to do it. Not saying it's wrong, but it certainly, I think, would lead to more answers about where these people come from and what's in the recipe.
Where they come from.
What are the seven herbs and spices that made up this person? Because,
another family. I would love to have everybody in a room and go over the family history and watch the way they interact with each other and how they, what stories they tell that explain all this. And again, it makes me think of people who are not terribly insightful.
Siobhan, you would have the best reality show of all times if you could, if we could set you up in a room with all these families and call it Family Therapy Live.
I'd be up for that. I would be up
with
for that.
With Nutter's Live, something like that. Just
What would be the most telling way to figure out the dynamics of these people in a room without like putting them on the spot, without asking questions where they're going to lock up? Would it be like playing a game like Monopoly or something and just observing the interactions? I think that would be very telling.
What's Siobhan's opening gambit? What does she put out there first?
How would you bamboozle people to find out what's going on in their brains, Siobhan?
No, I would just, you find so much from people. Tell me the story. Yeah. Tell me the story of your family. And you can pretty much tell who's got a different story from who else's story. You can see who dominates. Yeah. You can see the rationalizations. And just letting people talk. You know, you make a safe space for them to open up and talk. You don't really give feedback when you're gathering data. Mm-hmm. Probably a lot like law enforcement. If you
it's exactly what we do when we're interviewing anyone.
Yeah.
We're building sources. Same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, just get them talking, and I take notes on everything people say, and you start to see patterns.
Yeah, it's another fascinating case. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in with your thoughts. All right, that's going to wrap up this edition of the program. Siobhan's latest book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Go check it out, and also available on audiobook. And Robin's latest, It's Not All About Me, also available wherever you get books, also available on audiobook.
And we both read it too, and I smile every time you mention Siobhan's because I love that book so much.
Yes.
And yours is very, very useful.
Go and check them all out. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
David Anthony Burke, D4VD, built a career on a skill most people don't think of as a skill. He could make you believe he'd lived something he hadn't. Over a billion streams, Coachella, a tour with SZA. The whole time, Burke was telling interviewers on the record, in his own words, that most of what he wrote about had never actually happened to him. He told Dazed he created fake scenarios in his head and turned them into songs. He told NME his earlier music was him living vicariously through so many different people. He told People magazine he used to base his personality off the next game he played. His breakthrough song, Romantic Homicide, wasn't about a real relationship. It was invented, performed, and millions of people believed it was real because the performance was that convincing. I mean, a lot of music does that. Artists do that. I'm not saying it's anything that's strange. It certainly happens. It's just when we get into the context of where David is sitting today and the charges against him and the content of said songs, it makes it feel a little bit different. As we go through this, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube, because we're going to try and dig here into who David is and who he isn't. And I'm wondering if at the end of the day, David even knows who he is. I keep coming back to that. Not the charges, not the evidence. We've covered all of that. What I am thinking a lot about is the person underneath. What happens when someone's foundational life skill, the thing that made him famous, the thing that launched them from a closet in Houston to stages around the world, is the ability to perform emotions they don't actually feel? What is it look like when that skill set gets applied outside of a recording studio? You know, it's something we talk about in a lot of cases too. I mean, think about it. We talk about it in Koberger's case. We've talked about it in many cases where someone does something so horrific. You try to wrap your mind around what is going on with this person. And a common theme that we see is lack of feeling, lack of emotion, lack of being empathetic. People who do these sort of crimes, and again, everything here is opinion, my opinion, in my opinion, alleged, etc. People who do these sorts of things, they're not empathetic humans. They completely are lacking that quality. But sometimes with folks like that, and they've even, you know, I've watched interviews, I've done interviews with people who do lack this. A common theme, I would say, is a desire to feel the way others do. And quite often they have to mimic, they have to basically pretend to get through life. And some people go through their entire lives doing that just fine. I mean, just fine to the outside world, where the outside world doesn't notice it that much. But to that individual who is lacking that empathy, lacking those feelings, lacking any emotion, being completely indifferent, nihilism, if you will, in some cases, the way people look at things, some are desiring to feel. Some at one point did feel. I mean, Koberger wrote about that, where it suddenly at some point it's just like it was gone, and he didn't know why. And he chased it. And sometimes with people like this, they end up going to very big extremes to feel, quote unquote. That's how you get serial killers. That's how you get these types of characters. David was writing about it in his music and talking about it before anything even happened. That disconnect is what's interesting. This episode is about all that, not the timeline, not the charges, the person. Who is David Anthony Berg? And what allegedly made any of this possible? I'm curious to get your thoughts in the comments as we work our way through it. Berg, like I said, has pled not guilty to all charges. His defense team maintains he did not commit this crime and was not the cause of Celeste Rivas Hernandez's death. He's entitled to that presumption, and a jury will decide whether the prosecution can prove otherwise. Here's what we know about how David Anthony Berg grew up. And I want to be clear, none of this is speculation. This comes from Berg's own interviews given freely before any of this happened. We're going to try and go through it as accurately as possible, okay? He was born in Queens, moved to Houston as a kid, and after seventh grade, he was pulled out of school entirely, homeschooled by his mother in a religious household, gospel music only, until he was 13 years old. No cafeteria, no hallway drama, no PE classes, no learning how to read other people's faces in real time because the girl you like is standing 3 feet away and you have to figure out what that expression means right now in front of everyone with no do-over. Like the things most of us go through in adolescence in a school setting. Through most of us learn the basics of emotional literacy. Berg didn't get that. And sometimes even when exposed to that, people still don't get it. It's not always an exposure thing. Sometimes it's just not there. His social world was a screen. Fortnite lobbies, YouTube comment sections, Discord servers. The people he interacted with were avatars and usernames, and the version of himself he showed them was whatever he chose to type or say into a microphone. It's one thing when you're an adult and you've lived a bit of life and you've had these experiences and you're able to, I guess, have somewhat of a avatar-y life because you already have established yourself and who you are and what you are to other people. When that is the core definition of who you are and that's what makes you up, that spells trouble. He told the CBC that the first concert he ever attended was his own. That's an interesting one. He went from zero real-world social experience to standing on a stage performing emotions for thousands of people, and the audience didn't know the difference because there was no difference to detect. The performance was the person. The person was the performance. He'd been practicing in his sister's walk-in closet on an iPhone since he was 16. Now, look, going to get it because we get this all the time. I'm not saying homeschooling creates problems. Millions of homeschool kids turn out just fine. Okay, so before anybody's like, yeah, it's homeschool, blah, blah. Okay, I get it. I'm sorry you're that triggered by someone just bringing up the word homeschooled, and then it turns out that this person was homeschooled and they're kind of a monster. It doesn't mean homeschooling did it. We know that, okay? I get it. I understand it. Not saying homeschooling is bad, so before you get a... Millions of homeschooled kids turned out just fine. But Burke himself described what that isolation did to him. He said he lived vicariously through other people's experiences. He said he created fake emotional scenarios and turned them into content. He said he'd never had a real relationship, never navigated real conflict, never dealt with real loss, and he built an entire musical identity out of performing those things anyway. He learned that isolation, the gap between what you protect and what you actually feel, is a space you can live inside comfortably. And then nobody checks. That's the developmental foundation for David. That's what everything else allegedly sits on. So let's talk about what that skill allegedly became when the stakes stopped being Spotify streams and started being a human life. There are three layers to this, and each one builds on the one before that. So we got that first foundation, if you will. The first layer on top of that is manufactured authenticity as a career. When Withered dropped his debut album, reportedly it released 2 days after prosecutors alleged Celeste Rivas Hernandez was killed. Burke told NME it was the first time he'd ever put his own emotions into his music. He spent years succeeding by performing emotions that weren't his. He understood the distinction between what was manufactured and what was real well enough to market the difference. He could toggle between them. Emotional here, not emotional there. Compartmentalization. That's not a flaw in his artistry. That's what made his artistry work. But it's also allegedly the same skill that prosecutors say allowed him to sit down for a relaxed interview with the Zach Sang show the morning after Celeste was allegedly killed, smiling, joking, doing morning radio. Tour's coming up, isn't it? Wow, what's going on in your world? Oh, not much. Not much. Just got a kiddie pool in the mail and a couple chainsaws. That didn't come up in the interview. He was talking about how heartbreak, it affected him, failed relationships, inspired his album. If the prosecution's allegations are accurate, he wasn't hiding what happened. He was performing it as if it hadn't happened. The second layer is about secrecy, not as something Burke allegedly did, but is something that allegedly defined the way he moved through the world long before anyone alleges a crime even took place. Burke grew up hidden, homeschooled behind closed doors, recording in a closet. His entire creative life happened in private before it was performed in public. And according to prosecutors, when the alleged relationship with Celeste began, reportedly online when she was 11, the infrastructure of concealment that allegedly grew around it wasn't improvised. It was, according to the people's brief, allegedly systematic. He just kind of molded right into all the wrong that is all of this case. Here's what I mean. In February 24, Riverside County deputies found Burke's phone number in Celeste's records after her family reported her missing. They called him. According to prosecutors, he told them he'd last spoken to her days earlier and claimed he had no idea she was a minor. The same night, LA County deputies conducted a welfare check at his Hollywood Hills rental. They told him to his face, she's 13 years old. She's a runaway. And according to the People's Brief, while standing in front of those deputies and telling them he'd only met Celeste once in person, despite all the evidence otherwise, Burke showed them a yearbook photo of her that he had saved on his phone. Hit a yearbook photo of this child on his phone while telling law enforcement he barely knew her. It's an interesting detail. It tells you a little more about the alleged psychology of this case than really any label I could put on it. I only know her, seen her once, only know her a little bit. I got her yearbook photo, right? 2 days later, Celeste went home. Her parents took her phone, and according to prosecutors, Burke's response to being told by law enforcement that she was 13 was not to stop, not to go, all right, she's a kid. I, too, am barely a kid. Parents are asking me to stop. I should stop. No, he allegedly drove to Lake Elsinore and paid a junior high school student $1,000 to deliver a phone he'd purchased so the two could keep talking. He's got a really good compartmentalization of right and wrong going on here, and he can choose seemingly at will where he wants to go with it. TMZ's reported she allegedly had multiple fake IDs. Sources who socialized with Burke's circle told TMZ they believe Celeste was a 19-year-old USC student. At one party in Los Angeles in July of 24, a photograph surfaced that appears to show Celeste standing behind Burke, her hand covering her face, the matching tattoos on both the right index fingers. The secret phone, the alleged fake identities, the hand over the face. According to prosecutors, secrecy wasn't a byproduct of the alleged relationship. It was allegedly the entire operating system. Everything was secret. Everything was private. Everything was cordoned off. Everything was very systematic in a very controlled environment. And Burke, someone who'd spent his whole life building things in hidden spaces, allegedly knew exactly how to run one. And the third layer is the one that makes the first two really land here. According to prosecutors, Burke was allegedly living two completely parallel realities at the same time. It happened for over a year before Celeste was allegedly killed. On one side, he was touring with SZA, performing at Coachella, doing press about vulnerability and first love and emotional growth. On the other, according to the people's brief, allegedly maintaining an ongoing relationship with a child, allegedly traveling with her to London, Las Vegas, and Texas, allegedly introducing her to his family, and nobody around him allegedly saw through it because the version of David Anthony Burke that the public knew was the only version most people had ever encountered. The performed one, the curated one, the one he'd been building since he was a kid in a closet with an iPhone and a head full of scenarios that belonged to other people. Which again, if you're young, if you're creative, that's how creative life starts. It is a lot of ideas that probably belong to other people or that you conjured up. You have to live some life. What happens when you put all the weight and responsibilities of real life onto someone whose experiences are not real? And go, hey, live. Go out there, demonstrate this. Live your truth. Live whatever it may be. And the guardrails aren't there, and that person's sense of right and wrong and morality and what's okay and what's not okay and a desire to feel something because your music is so emotionally vulnerable and about feeling, but you still don't really know how to feel things. Well, that creates a fine recipe that does very much explain, in my opinion, David. He's this character that feels so deeply and emotionally, and yet David can't feel deeply or emotionally. But he wants to be this artist. He wants to be this figure that he's been made up to be. Your music's macabre. It's about death. It's about murder. It's about horrible things. It's about heartbreak. It's about all of it. Well, if you're not feeling it and you're about to go out on tour and you really need to be on stage and pull this act off, and you are incapable of feeling because all these ideas, all these scenarios are not yours, but now it's time to shine, what do you do? Well, you better go practice. You better get some reps in those feelings and these scenarios. And, well, kind of looks like that happened. Was that the motivation for ending the life of Celeste if he did it? I don't know. But it sure gave him some something to think about when he's singing his songs, now, didn't it? According to prosecutors, the wall cracked. And on April 22nd of 2025, the People's Brief says Celeste and Burke got into a heated argument via text. She allegedly threatened to expose their relationship and destroy his career. His debut album was 3 days from release, the multi-million dollar career, the persona, the public identity. According to prosecutors, everything allegedly depended on the secret staying secret. It's not going to work out well if it turns out he's involved with a child. And it's also not going to work out well if he's going on stage and he's singing somebody else's lyrics and can't feel what he's supposed to feel, and he's this big emotional artist. It's almost two birds with one stone in a real sick sort of way. And for the first time, the person holding the secret allegedly threatened to open it. The prosecution's theory is that Burke made a choice. Career or the person who could end it. And according to prosecutors, here's what they allege happened over the next 48 hours. On April 23rd, an Uber brought Celeste to Burke's Hollywood Hills rental. Prosecutors allege Burke stabbed her and, per the People's Brief, stood by as she bled out. She was 14. Just turned it. The morning of April 24th, according to the prosecution's filing, Burke ordered a shovel via Postmates, returned to the house and did a radio interview. Texted Celeste's phone, the phone of a person prosecutors say he had just killed, and what they allege was a calculated move to create a false trail. On April 25th, Withered dropped. Burke reportedly attended a release party. In the days that followed, prosecutors allege he ordered chainsaws, a body bag, heavy-duty laundry bags, and an inflatable pool under the name Victoria Mendez, and had them delivered to his rental. If the prosecution's theory is accurate, what that sequence reveals isn't rage, isn't someone who snapped, it's the opposite. According to prosecutors, Burke moved between his hidden world and the public one across multiple days, the same way he'd been doing for over a year and the same way, arguably, he'd been doing his entire life. Toggle, perform, compartmentalize. The kid who learned to write songs about feelings he'd never actually felt had learned to do something far darker. If these allegations hold, to carry on as though nothing had changed. Because for someone who spent 20 years in the gap between performance and reality, there was no seam to cross. It was all the same space. I'm not going to recap what we just walked through. You heard it. You felt it. What I want to leave you with is the part that doesn't have a legal answer. Burke's biggest song is called Romantic Homicide. His mother heard it and told him it was too violent, allegedly. In February 25, he released the music video for One More Dance, which shows him dragging a body and putting it in the trunk of a car. Nearly 4 million views on that one. He leaked a track on SoundCloud years ago. And the album... The one released 2 days after prosecutors say Celeste died inside his house is called Withered. We don't get to say what that means. Artists write dark material. Dark material isn't evidence. But David Anthony Burke spent his entire conscious life in the space between what's imagined and what's real, between what's performed and what's felt. In the years, the very formative years where you're just trying to figure out the basics of all of that, between what the audience sees and what's actually happening behind the curtain. He told us that himself in interview after interview. We heard it as charm. We heard it as a quirky origin story. Homeschooled kid makes music in closet. Lives vicariously through people on the internet, writes about heartbreak he's never experienced. What a great underdog narrative. He's going to go live life and write even better stuff, right? Well, according to prosecutors, the allegations in this case suggest the same space, the gap between the performance and the person, is where a 14-year-old girl disappeared. A court will decide whether David Anthony Burke is guilty. That's not my job. But the question I'm walking away with, and I think you might be too, is the one that doesn't get answered at trial. How does someone allegedly build a public life that millions of people believed in while allegedly living a completely different one behind it and is able to switch it like that? How many people were close enough to see the cracks and didn't? And what does it say about us, about the people we follow, the art we consume, the stories we tell ourselves about who someone is when the version of the person we believe was the only one they'd been rehearsing since they were a kid alone in a closet with an iPhone? Celeste Rivas Hernandez would have turned 16 this September. She was 14 years old when she walked into that house for the last time, and she never walked out. Make sure to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Not an excuse for any of David's behavior, but an interesting way of trying to understand it and frame it and look at it and go, huh. When you do this with a person, this is the recipe that made that person. Is it all that surprising that this is what you got out of it? I would venture to say in this case, no. If you really take a deep look. And look, you could run somebody like David or run another child exactly through the exact same experiences that David went through, and you're not going to get a murderer. But you get the right type of person in this scenario, and all this plays out this way, and there's enough of those disconnects there with other humanity, other human beings, you get a dangerous scenario. And the thing I think that scares a lot of people about this in this digital world, and that, oh, he was online, is that, yeah, that's a lot of kids. That's like a lot. That's a high percentage of children that are living as digitally and disconnected from humanity as David was. So what does that mean? What does that say about generations that are coming up and the oh so many who have just the right personality to go off the rails because we don't know where the guardrails actually are because we've never lived this before. We've never raised people like this before in this type of environment. So any of the adults up here going, the guardrails should be here, there, I think, maybe over there. It's all uncharted territory. And I think it's a scary thought of how many more Davids can be produced, are produced, are living out there right now. Capable of the same sort of thing should they need to act in whatever way best serves their interests. And it doesn't need to be a world tour. Again, your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube. We'll continue it there. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.